Today, the prevalence and misuse of non-disclosure agreements, and Dan Sabber on the surprise sacking of Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson. You've heard of non-disclosure agreements.
The recent avalanche of sexual harassment allegations has cast a spotlight on non-disclosure agreements.
Legal trouble for President Trump. Stormy Daniels, the adult film star who said she had an affair with Trump, is now filing a lawsuit against the president, arguing that the non-disclosure agreement she signed...
No longer is it okay to pay off perpetrators and bribe victims into silence. Or is that what companies still think they should be doing?
NDAs, sometimes known as gagging orders, reach across a wide range of sectors. The film industry, advertising, financial industries, and even in higher education.
Universities have spent nearly £90 million on payoffs since 2017.
The term non-disclosure agreement seems ubiquitous today, but it wasn't always that way.
I hadn't heard of the phrase or NDA until I decided to break it, until I started speaking to journalists.
In 2017, when Harvey Weinstein's former assistant Zelda Perkins decided to break the terms of her settlement, it shone a new light on NDAs and how they were being used. Non-disclosure agreements can be really useful to employers and also employees, but some feel they've become insidious and often unethical.
Originally, NDAs started out protecting trade secrets. I think NDAs have morphed into something much broader, which seems to be trying to gag a portion of the population from speaking about experiences of sexual harassment or assault or other misconduct that they've experienced.
NDAs are now under scrutiny. From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesson. Today in Focus, is it time to rethink non-disclosure agreements? Zelda Perkins worked for Harvey Weinstein in her early 20s as his assistant. In 2017, she broke a non-disclosure agreement that she'd signed when she left her job at Miramax. She told a parliamentary select committee that's been set up to examine the use of NDAs why she decided to leave the company.
I resigned because he sexually assaulted and attempted to rape a colleague of mine. A colleague who had recently been employed, she'd only been with the company for a month and had only met him once. And obviously, when somebody comes to you saying that's happened, there's not much choice of what you should do. So we considered ourselves constructively dismissed at that point.
Zelda told me about the lead-up to her signing the NDA.
So when she told me what happened, I went and confronted him immediately.
How did he react?
Well, it was interesting because he was in a very important meeting. And as I was going down to the place where he was in his meeting, I was concerned that I was going to be able to get him out, because for me to interrupt him in this specific meeting was going to be a real problem. I went over to him and tapped him on the shoulder and said to him, "You need to come with me right away." And to me, he admitted his guilt in that instance because he didn't lose a beat. He looked at me, he stood up, and he walked away with me. And he was leaving a meeting that had been set up for months, that there was a lot of anticipation and, you know, importance surrounding. And in normal circumstances, if I had gone and tapped him on the shoulder in the middle of a meeting like that, he would have ripped my head off.
What happens? You're clearly very angry.
Yeah, I was very angry. I confronted him. He lied to me, he said that absolutely nothing had happened, and he swore on the life of his wife and children, which also, for me, was a clear marker of his guilt, because I'd heard him only use that phrase as a real get out of jail when he was caught doing something really bad. I didn't know what the official route was to go. We didn't have an HR department. At that time, because of the setup at work, we didn't have any senior staff. And the only person that I had to speak to, who was senior to me, just advised me to get myself a lawyer. We found lawyers who were literally across the street from our offices. And within a pretty short amount of time, it was made very clear to us that we had no case in finding justice through the court system.
What grounds were his word against hers?
That it would be, yeah, his word against ours, that we had no physical proof. Basically, we were disavowed of any possibility of going. It was too late to go to the police. We didn't have any physical evidence. We had no power in the situation at all. And I was completely stunned by this because I had just presumed it would be very simple once we went to the law.
When you were going to the lawyers, going to Disney, what did you want out of this? What did you...
We wanted to be exposed and we wanted justice. So I presumed that we would end up going to court, that there would be some form of criminal proceedings and that he may even go to prison.
So what actually happened?
We were told that a settlement agreement was our only course of action. We resigned from the company. And once I was told that our only course of action was an agreement, was a contract, our thoughts were, okay, so if we have to enter into a contract, the most important thing that comes out of this is that his behaviour stopped and that people are protected. So I started coming up with clauses to put into the agreement that would curtail his behaviour and protect people in the future. At this point, I was told that if I wanted to get any of these things, we would have to make a monetary demand.
What did you get a sense of at that point what that money was about? Was it about guaranteeing confidentiality, guaranteeing silence? What? Why did they bring up the money?
Initially, it's about loss of office. We'd resigned because of his behaviour. But it became clear as we started discussing this agreement that we would also be expected, most likely, to not ever be able to discuss this.
So how did it get to the point where you are all in that room signing an agreement?
It all happened pretty quickly. We had a week of negotiations, which I had sort of presumed would be done just by our representatives, our legal representatives, and the majority of it was. But we had 3 days of negotiations, which we were part of. Two of those sessions were 12 hours long. One started at 5 PM and went on until 5 the following morning. We were then taxied home and then we had to be back there at 11 o'clock the following for another 6-hour session. So it was incredibly intense and intimidating and discombobulating for two young women who also we'd only ever worked in the media environment, which, as you know, is much more sort of casual and open. And we were suddenly in the city being kept in a room where we were not allowed pen and paper. We were not allowed to speak to anybody other than our own representatives. We had to be accompanied to the loo.
When you signed it, when you walked out, What was the kind of overwhelming feeling then?
Well, we were broken. We were utterly broken, even though we had got nearly all of our demands in the agreement in terms of putting in an HR system to try and protect future employees with 3 complaint handlers, one of whom had to be an attorney. Harvey had to go to therapy and I had to be present for the first session to make sure that the pertinent issue was discussed, that if he made a settlement similar to ours in the following 3 years, that either he was fired from the company or it was reported to Disney. All things which clearly, I'm afraid, show his acceptance of responsibility for some form of pretty heinous act. But even though we got all of those things, I felt that it probably was a sham by virtue of the fact that I had gone through this process, which was, as far as I was aware, legally correct and yet totally morally debase.
So on leaving, what did you understand in terms of the terms of this confidentiality or gagging order?
Well, interestingly, we weren't allowed to hold a copy of the agreement because it was such a smoking gun. We were allowed to go and view the agreement in our lawyers' offices. We had also been made to identify any person that we'd made any form of disclosure to. You know, we also weren't allowed to speak to a therapist or to our accountant.
Not a therapist?
No, we were allowed to, but they had to sign a confidentiality agreement. If the therapist then broke that confidence, it would have, the Miramax would have come after us for the breach, not after the therapist. So we had guns pointing at us from every angle. We weren't allowed to talk to HMRC about our payment. We had to direct any questions from them through Alan and Overy.
What about partners, loved ones?
Nobody.
Parents?
Nobody.
Each other?
When we left that room, we took a taxi together and then we said goodbye to each other in that taxi, and we knew that we wouldn't ever speak to each other again.
How long were you under this agreement?
In perpetuity.
But how long actually?
20 years.
20 years. When did you start thinking, I want to break this?
There was clearly a cultural change beginning to happen. We'd had Jimmy Savile, Cosby, Bill O'Reilly. So there was exposure of these powerful figures beginning to happen. I had several cold call approaches from journalists.
Inverted commas.
Inverted commas.
Speech marks.
Yes, journalists, because it now appears that a couple of those were actually Black Cube operatives, which were Harvey's security team that he employed.
God. What, checking that you didn't speak?
Yeah.
Okay. So how did you do it? How did you break it?
Jodie Kantor called me in June of 2017.
Okay, and Jodie Kantor is one of the New York Times reporters who broke the story.
She was very smart because she was the first journalist who called me and said, I don't want to ask you any questions, I just want to tell you some things. And she listed to me some facts that I knew only the top execs at Miramax, Harvey, particular movie stars who he was having affairs or now it appears less than consensual affairs with, would have known. I knew that that powerful people were beginning to give the truth. And at that moment, that was, for me, was a bingo moment. So I was like, okay, if they're speaking, then this house of cards is going to fall.
Harvey Weinstein's former assistant at Miramax is breaking her non-disclosure agreement and revealing his alleged sexual harassment. Perkins and a colleague split a settlement with Miramax of about $425,000 and signed a non-disclosure agreement back in 1998.
When, at what point did you realise that a lot of other people have been under NDAs?
It's still really coming to light. I thought that when I broke my NDA, it would give a lot of people courage to also break theirs. I don't think it did. I think it gave a few people courage too, but not very many. And that just shows you the thrall that these agreements hold people under. They are still intimidated by them. People are still so afraid of the consequences of breaking these non-disclosure agreements.
You now believe that NDAs should be banned in cases of workplace harassment, don't you?
I do. Yeah. I genuinely do not believe that there is a place for confidentiality around illegal, criminal, discriminatory, poor behaviour in the workplace. It's a human right to be able to work in safety. We have, you know, health and safety rules in the office that protect us from everything other than sexual harassment, racial abuse, maternity discrimination. And the Select Committee inquiry that's in place at the moment is really pushing and investigating the legislation around non-disclosure agreements. And what's become staggeringly clear is that they are so insidious in so many areas now. And in all these companies, the left hand hasn't been speaking to the right. Half the time, the board doesn't even know that their company has 4, 10, 12, 100 non-disclosure agreements.
Because they're confidential.
Because they're confidential. And also the payments that are made to people aren't audited. So if it's a public company, that's shareholders' money. If it's happening in Parliament, that's taxpayers' money. There hasn't been legislation or regulation that has kept up with their creep into unethical territory.
Georgina Calvert-Lee leads a UK employment and equality team at the law firm McAllister Olivarius. Since the Me Too movement, she says she's seen a growing number of people coming to her asking about breaking their NDAs.
When people are presented with an NDA, they're usually in a really distressed state because they have often put up with maybe years, at least months, of really bad conduct. And so they're distressed from that. They then have come to a lawyer, so they think they want to bring a lawsuit. And I have had to tell them that they have 3 months in which to decide whether to bring a lawsuit or not. But first, before they can bring a lawsuit, they have to exhaust all of the remedies that their employer may have in their organisation, which effectively means they have to go back to their employer, put in a grievance, maybe appeal. And after they've done that, whether or not that appeal process is completed, they've then very quickly got to decide whether to file a claim with the employment tribunal. And the stress comes about from the very, very short time period in which they have to make all of these decisions. If they want to bring a claim in the tribunal, they have only 3 months from the last act of harassment.
Why? Why is it 3 months?
Well, that's very what quick. The law says, unfortunately. I know, it's
Why
perplexing.
Does it say that?
Yeah, I do wonder. And I am often suggesting it should be made different because in any other claim, or most other claims, personal injury, for instance, you have 3 years to bring your claim.
So in the last couple of years, there have been some very high-profile cases of NDAs used by movie mogul Harvey Weinstein and Philip Green of the Arcadia Group, which runs brands like Topshop. When cases like these become huge, become famous, does that change the conversation around NDAs?
In theory, you would think that they're more likely to be used where there's a celebrity involved. So often you see really draconian NDAs in quite plain vanilla cases where there aren't celebrities involved that I'm not sure they're that different. I think the one that got a lot of publicity, Zelda Perkins' NDA in the Harvey Weinstein case, did seem to be a particularly draconian form of NDA.
What was it about her agreement that struck you?
Well, it struck me that she wasn't even allowed to speak to a therapist.
So it's often about reputation for employers, but isn't there also a risk for employers now of being known for just using NDAs?
You see, people have been signing NDAs for years, but they weren't allowed to talk about it. So until the Me Too movement, until Zelda Perkins, no one was aware of the scale of the problem of NDAs, and so it wouldn't have factored into an employer's range of risks that they would get bad publicity for having asked someone to sign an NDA. They just assumed. They may have been told by their lawyers, oh, don't worry, this is all part of a settlement agreement. So they wouldn't have thought that they were doing anything wrong or objectionable. And they would have actually thought they were probably pretty stupid if they didn't offer an NDA because that was just the standard thing.
So you do think things are changing then?
I do think the attitude towards NDAs are changing. People are becoming more educated. People now know that there are such things as NDAs. So now I would hope that when any individual is offered a settlement agreement with an NDA, they would give it second thought and they would ask their lawyer, do I really have to have this?
And so rather than issuing NDAs and just brushing the problem under the carpet, what else should employers be doing?
Employers need to have a very robust and carefully thought through investigation procedure. They need to have very good training because, of course, the best thing would be if this misconduct didn't happen in the first place.
I mean, what would it look like if companies started sort of going, yeah, we've had another bullying case and we've dealt with it. We've had a sexual harassment case. This is how we dealt with it.
I think you'd end up having a lot fewer cases. And employees will feel a lot safer knowing that if they make a complaint, it's not hushed up. It has a very chilling effect on the workforce to hear through rumour and speculation that you think someone put in a grievance, but then you know that nothing has changed. The person you think they were being bullied by is still in place, and lo and behold, the person who made the complaint has left. That has a much worse effect, I think, than being very transparent about your procedures and actually having good procedures that you're kind of proud of, so you don't mind being transparent about them.
Georgina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Harvey Weinstein continues to vehemently deny any criminal acts and maintains that any sexual acts with the women who've made allegations were consensual. Coming up, Dan Sabba on the surprise sacking of Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson. Welcome back. Last week, there was a leak from a National Security Council meeting about tech giant Huawei's access to Britain's 5G network. And then, on Wednesday, after he refused to resign, Theresa May fired Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson, telling him she had seen compelling evidence that he'd had an 11-minute phone call with the journalist who then broke the story. He denied being the leak. Dan Sabba is the defence and security editor for The Guardian and has been following Williamson's rise and rapid fall.
This is quite the turn of events. Theresa May made Gavin Williamson. You know, he was the man who was behind her leadership campaign, the organiser in chief. He then became, having risen out of nowhere, the chief whip, you know, and held the government together, particularly after the 2017 election, keeping the DUP on board, propping the Prime Minister up, helping win votes. And yet, in this kind of moment of high drama in Downing Street yesterday, she says to him, "I think you leaked to the Daily Telegraph and I don't believe your denials." Tuesday last week, actually, the National Security Council meets. What's the National Security Council? It's a cabinet committee, but it's an unusual cabinet committee. It's got about 10 or so senior cabinet members on it, including, of course, the Prime Minister and the Defence Secretary and others, like the Home Secretary and Foreign Secretary. But it's also got service chiefs and spy chiefs. So it's a combination of the kind of the secret world, the military world and the political world. Within a couple of hours of that meeting, there was a front page splash story saying that after a tense and difficult meeting, five cabinet ministers objecting, Huawei was narrowly approved as a supplier in 5G networks. Leaks out of cabinet more broadly have been out of control in the last few months as Theresa May's authority has dwindled because of the rows about Brexit. But nobody really expected that it would get to the point where someone would hand the evidence and the Prime Minister would pull the metaphorical trigger. So what happened after Williamson got fired, you know, into the night on Wednesday night, absolutely extraordinary. You know, Williamson spoke to several journalists sounding off about this, saying that the Prime Minister got it wrong, that he was the victim of a kangaroo court, that he wanted the opportunity to clear his name, perhaps through, criminal inquiry. And most memorably of all, that he swore on his children's life. On his children's lives, that he did not leak the information. And it's sort of a classic kind of Williamson quote, you know, sort of, you know, passionate and I suppose, and but also just slightly, dare I say it, childish. When he was promoted to be Defence Secretary in November 2017, things haven't gone always quite so well for him. He said some very silly things, and you know, many of which he managed to leak. He once suggested paintballing Spanish ships that stray into territorial waters around Gibraltar. You know, told Russia that
frankly, Russia should go away, should shut up.
One of the other more improbable suggestions was that one might, as a sort of cost-saving measure, perhaps sort of fit missiles onto tractors, which I suppose is an alternative to tanks. Afterwards, there's been a debate about whether, Williamson should now be prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act, given the nature of the leak. Well, Downing Street says it doesn't want to pursue the matter, although, unsurprisingly, the Labour Party, and I think the Lib Dems as well, have said the Metropolitan Police should look into it and a prosecution should be considered. If there's a serious police investigation, or any police investigation worth its salt, you'd have to go to the offices of the Daily Telegraph, you'd have to try and mount some kind of raid there, interview the journalist involved. The idea of criminalising leaks is deeply unattractive. an absence of leaks going forward might prove that Williamson was, arguably prove that Williamson was the leaker, or was a leaker more generally of cabinet material. But I just feel like, who's going to want to take the risk right now? And the stakes are really high because there's a Tory leadership contest around the corner, and who wants to make a mistake that could be fatal? Williamson hadn't hoped to run, but he had hoped to be kingmaker. And, well, he may get to do something like that as chief disturber from the backbenches or some such. But he has been damaged by this, there's no doubt.
That's all for today. My thanks to Dan Sabber and to Zelda Perkins and Georgina Calvert-Lee. And thanks to you, of course, for listening. And if you do have a minute, don't forget to vote for us in the People's Choice Award at the British Podcast Awards. Today's episode was produced by Meera Sharma, Mithili Rao, Leia Green and Gary Marshall. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll see you on Monday.